Welcome to Watching Dead, the officially unofficial podcast for The Walking Dead on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 9, Episode 14, titled Scars. Aaron, what do you think of this episode?
I really like this episode. I was somewhat underwhelmed with the actual origin of the scars being a simple branding. Like, I had worked myself up into thinking there was some kind of complicated organ theft.
Yeah.
You know, like there's some kind of repo man outfit needing kidneys and taking kidneys.
I was looking for Forrest Whitaker. I never found him.
And that never manifests, but man, they did the betrayal of Michonne and making it so personal and so scary. And then, like, they, as soon as, like, I saw that it was, like, her best friend, this one in a million thing, they gave her this pep talk about Rick and then broke her heart in the morning. I'm like, oh, I can see why Michonne is such a hardliner. And it just kept getting worse.
Right. Yeah, I love how they paired the Judith stuff off, you know, and then the flashback and the present day. You know, that really, it runs the risk of feeling too writerly, right? Like, too arranged, but I thought it worked out really well.
Yeah, and it's like, I thought, I'm really liking Judith more and more because, like, I thought that moment where she had a talk about, like, a level talk with her mom about, like, the things that happened in the past that Michonne is... Michonne assumes she's protecting her from so many things that this kid had memories of, which, you know, makes sense that, you know, you remember things that are like, super, I don't know, you remember random shit when you're real young, but like things that are like traumatic or impressive or whatever, you're gonna have a much better odds of remembering a war crime or a Walt Disney trip at 3 years old than a random, you know, trip to the grocery store, right?
Sure,
so, yeah. It all made perfect sense, and I really enjoyed seeing Rutina Wesley. I'm a big True Blood fan, and she's a pretty big part of that show, and they cast her as Jocelyn, as Joss here, and I thought that was super effective, which I'll talk about in the commentary itself, but it's really nice seeing her again, and again, you know, they're just effortlessly playing with these stakes and some of the stuff that I thought was annoying or like, you know, geez, oh, is the payoff ever going to be worth it for the scar shit? Yeah, it really was. So I was really happy, really pleased with this episode. How about you?
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you said. I don't know. We're 14 episodes into season 9 and... the first seven, the last seven seasons don't feel like they didn't happen at this point. I still remember like the shitty road that we had to hoe to get here. But they've really turned it around this season. I think, you know, it's, I don't know how I'm still waiting for the trade fair. And there's this paper tiger, literal paper tiger, to show up and see how that all concludes. But so far so good in this season.
It is. And that's the infuriating thing going forward about Walking Dead is to realize how easy it could have been, like a one season turnaround to, you know, like especially with the time jump that makes everything seem like, yeah, did that really happen? Or was this person's death as stupid as I thought? Like, they can just vaguely gesture to things like Glenn and Abraham's death.
Sure.
And you don't think, like, when Michonne and Negan were going toe to toe over that stuff, I'm not thinking Dumpster Glenn and Dolphin Smooth and all the other stupid shit. I'm just thinking of like, oh, right. Yeah. This like Christ. And he had an honest conversation with Judith about that. Holy shit. It works. It works. And that's, I guess, the frustrating thing is like, man, you pulled Scott Gimple out 3 years ago. Boy, this show's in a lot better shape. It seems, or I don't know. Maybe the you'd have ran some fans off. I don't understand. Cause this isn't like fucking Shakespeare, right? This, you don't have to read subtitles to get this. It's just competent drama.
And I mean, they still do stupid shit. Like, they still have a somewhat low opinion of their audience, I think. Like, the final line in this episode, we have to tell Alpha. That's like, are you fucking kidding me? Does anyone watching this not realize that's exactly what they're gonna do first thing? So I don't know. It's a split. Like, yeah, the show itself has gotten much better, but I still feel like I just wish they had a little more faith in their audience across the board.
That's fair, because I was thinking like, what's wrong? And then I start thinking like, yeah, you're right. That is, is what? There's another Whisperer band. We don't know who this place is these people are affiliated with. We don't understand the significance of them stumbling upon the front gates of the kingdom at festival time.
Right.
We have to report back to the Alpha. There's some sort of festival of perhaps trade that could be, say, disrupted.
But I mean, it's so much better. And yeah, I guess when Angela Kang took over, I was like, okay, well, she's written some really good episodes of The Walking Dead. I just didn't think that one person could sort of step in and turn this whole ship around and take us back to shore. But it seems like she's done it. And I don't know if she's like swapped out the entire writing team or what, but it's gotten so much better.
Well, and that's the other thing is, I think that at some point in the last few years, the conventional, because like at the beginning of the golden age of television, like everyone just lined up to suck showrunner dick. You know, if you had a hot show, then they're endlessly fascinated with the interviews and, you know, postseason wrap ups and all that. And I feel like the last few years, some of that's calmed down a bit because it's kind of like, you know, it's a writer's room, blah, blah, blah. But man, this kind of proves that no, there, you can set a tone and you can, you know, I guess instill a sense of professionalism or maybe work ethic. Like maybe Scott just got to be a lazy showrunner. He's handed all this success very early on. He went from like essentially junior writer to executive producer in a single season. I don't want to psychoanalyze him, but turns out like having a competent showrunner that gives a shit about the material, that respects the fans and their characters, is a huge boon. And they're not just like interchangeable cogs in a machine. Some of them operate better than others, for sure.
Absolutely. And it's not like this season has particularly interesting material to work with and that's why it's better, right? It seems like they've had really super interesting material that they could have used in interesting ways in previous seasons, and they just didn't.
It really makes
or
me
they
wonder,
tried to use it the same way over and over again and it just wore off.
Yes, that's the thing. It makes me wonder like what Kang would have done with the Savior Wars, you know?
Yeah, man, I want to mulligan on that.
Over, yeah, if she'd taken over on Terminus and kind of goosed this stuff along a little bit, maybe cut out a whole but I don't know, because the thing is like, does this season feel overstuffed as far as terms of plot? It's taken its time, but it's invested its time much smarter than in previous iterations of the show. Like, you know, it wasn't just like, oh God, we need a 3-episode arc because what the hell else are we going to do that doesn't really connect with anything, doesn't move a character's arc forward. These things are all just like, there's 6 or 7 mini arcs that have been given to various characters and they play off each other. Like, look at the tension between Aaron and Michonne now, that Michonne's like right after Aaron's learned a hard lesson about, you know, going outside the walls, and he's gung-ho about security and law and order. Now suddenly there's tension between him and Michonne because Michonne's kind of changed her mind. Not because, you know, she went out clearing and went crazy, but she had a lot of conversations with people she respected and loved and were trying to, that natural interplay is what I think is fascinating. What makes us care about people when they die and want to and root for them to live, you know? Like, there's not as this is the first time in a long time I can't think of a single person in any of the communities where I'm actively rooting for them to die. Like, maybe Barcode Tattoo, that's his leftover, that's leftover Gimple stench, I think.
Yeah, no, you're right. I'm having trouble thinking of one.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, well, let's get over to the outline here, over to the recap. We start off with flashbacks, and this one's going to be tough because there are flashbacks interspersed randomly throughout this episode, and they're fast and furious with the cuts between modern day and the flashback.
I will say that I'm glad that Walking Dead didn't get try to get too fancy. It's just, you know, they threw a sepia tone filter on the stuff that happened in the way back, and It's super easy to tell from cut to cut, transition to transition, what timeline we're in. I feel like previous seasons wouldn't bother or would do something weird and fucked up.
Yeah,
with the palette or something would clash with their day for night shooting, but this was just, yeah, I had no trouble. But also, Michonne's hair is subtly different. You know, she's got the side. Yeah, she's got like side cut shaved in the current timeline where she's like, you know, wall to wall dread or temple to temple dread in the flashback scenes. But I'm glad because, like I said, yes. I feel like this could have gotten to be a mess if they didn't have something really simple and conventional and almost instinctual to tell the difference between like old and new.
I didn't notice any of that. The thing I noticed is how many children were being slain. That was what really grounded me in the flashbacks.
Yeah, yeah. The dozens of children meeting their end at the edge of Michonne's blade.
I thought that's what they were doing. Okay, flashback to a pregnant Michonne slaughtering washed up walkers down by the river where she finds Rick's revolver. And this is just after, like, it can't be more than a week after Rick's disappearance, right?
It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
Long enough for Daryl to walk the river to the ocean and back, but again, they're in the Baltimore area, so the river's the ocean's not that far away.
Yeah.
So yeah, probably a week or two, a couple maybe.
Daryl says he hasn't found Rick, but he'll never stop looking. He just wants to be alone while he does that. And then back in the present, Michonne ritually polishes Rick's gun, which is not a euphemism. Daryl shows up at the front gate with Henry, Lydia, and Connie in tow, and Michonne lets him in. We get a little more of the flashback, letting some survivors inside, including someone she knows named Jocelyn.
Yeah, so I think this, I like the reveal of how, I didn't really care how Judith got Rick's gun, but I thought it was cool that they showed, you know, her retrieving it out of the mud bank anyway, and then flash forward it to, you know, Judith's got her own little box, and she's restored and cleaned it and all that good stuff. And then I remember when they contrasted Daryl at the gates, and here you get this fantastic tension between Aaron, because Aaron's like, we're, you know, yeah, we all love Daryl, but he's got a stranger with him, stranger danger. And she's like, well, I trust Daryl. And then they flash back and compare it to her friend Jocelyn, played by Rutina Wesley. And I remember thinking when I just saw these children and, like, I couldn't tell, you know, everyone's hair is matted and they're filthy. And I'm like, I'm very curious of how they're going to make me. There's three episodes left in this season. How are they going to forge any kind of emotional connection that's worth a damn to have this actually play out? And boy, howdy, was I going to eat my words before the end of this episode?
Right. Angela Kang's like, hold my beer. And
yeah, yeah.
And just knocks out of the park in one, yeah.
Yeah, so, and I think it starts with you cast someone like Rutina Wesley, who has an enormous amount of chemistry with Danai Gurira, and they just fall into this, like, kind of, like, I mean, it's wild. Like, you know, this bestie that you thought you'd lost. It'd be like if I found you 15 years into the zombie apocalypse, you know? Like, what the fuck? Of course, I'd be maximum guard on you trying to steal my medicine, my food, my children, but...
Rightfully so, yeah.
I mean, infamous child stealer Jim Jones here.
Sure.
But I think you cast some, and that's you know, like, a lot... I feel like in previous seasons, they would waste on, like, casting like this, or they would cast some, you know, just above extra level that saves some money. But, you know, you get a professional here, and she's really good at doing exactly what she needs to do, and then subverting that thing for maximum emotional devastation, which... Yeah. As this I'll continue to go through and think and say how much I really enjoy what she did on the show. But yeah, that's how you make you care. Step one, cast an appealing person that has good chemistry with the main cast. So it feels like, you know, one of those old Star Trek The Next Generation episodes where Picard, you know, oh, we went to Starfleet together. Now we're both captains. And it's like, sometimes he had that chemistry with people and sometimes he did not.
Yeah.
The chemistry's in spades in this episode.
And, you know, probably going to get overlooked in this episode is Danai Gurira, because she's been on the show for so long and we're just so used to seeing her. But she's, you know, you can't bring in the guest actor to do really well unless the main actor is there to support them. And they've done that here.
I mean, she's a super duper star now. She can do literally anything. The show's extraordinarily lucky to continue having her.
I did find myself thinking that in scenes, like, what the fuck is she still doing on this show? Like, they can't keep Lauren Cohen around. They can't keep fucking Rick Ron, whatever his name is. I can't remember. Andrew Lincoln.
And Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln around. How is, and she is a much bigger star than either of those two. How is she still on this show? It felt like... She must just do this because, like, I don't have any, you know, I can't make movies year round. So I guess let's do this thing in Georgia for 2 weeks or whatever they want me to shoot. Done.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how the calculus played. It could be that, like, this is, she's still playing out her last pre-Black Panther contract.
Yeah,
it could be that, like, hey, I've got a nice, like, Dennis Rodman role in a huge Marvel franchise. Do I want to put all my eggs in that basket, or do I want to keep doing this other genre work and some other indie kind of stuff? Like, it could be just, you know, her building a nice portfolio. Because she does, especially, I don't know, the other thing is Angela Kang might be like, look, I know you've been dying out here on an island. I'm going to give you some good shit. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you some, you know... Like, it's funny because, like, wasn't 8 episodes I was clowning on the r/The Walking Dead subreddit for, like, oh, isn't it time for this show to start getting some Emmy nominations? And I'm like,
oh, yeah.
And that's still kind of ridiculous, but not nearly as ridiculous as it was to me 6 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about one of the things I didn't like. One of the few things I didn't like in this episode. This song that they play at the beginning, which I guess is by Boy Genius. It's called Souvenirs. Something about the tone of it when she's like out there slaughtering walkers and finding this gun. It sometimes they just don't choose the best music. And there was a case of that. I don't know what kind of weird shit they picked, you know, early on in this season.
Yeah, when Jesus was spinning records in Hilltop, I remember being bizarre choices.
Yeah. And when they were doing like a pan over the hilltop and their crops and stuff with the drone shot. And I remember just god awful music. And this isn't that bad, but it just tonally was weird to me.
Yeah, I think a lot of the, you know, I really praised the musical choices last week because some of those gonzo Wild West themes just really suited, you know, Angus Sampson and the Highwaymen really well. But yeah, no, this is something this show doesn't do particularly well is the licensed music. I said it's the anti-Breaking Bad, because Breaking Bad, every time they did throw some licensed music, it's like you either didn't hear from it, you never heard of it before, and it's a fucking banger, perfect for the shot, or it's something they had in their back pocket that they were just waiting for the right time to deploy.
Right.
This Crystal is just
Blue
like
Persuasion, something like that.
Well, she's out there looking for stuff, so let's type that into Google search, and souvenir, yeah, that's something you find, right? Okay, throw it in there. It might be that simple. It feels like it might be that simple. And unfortunately, that's not the best.
I mean, you got Bear McCreary, who, you know, is doing, still doing the music for this show 528 years later. So I don't know why you got to go to this mediocre to bad pop music.
It's almost shit that, like, you think they invented for the show. And then you look it up and I'm like, oh, no, they actually got a license for that.
Yeah. All right. Henry gets his leg sewn up. We're obviously in the modern times here. Connie thanks Michonne for everything, but she just gets the stink eye from her. Aaron says no one seemed to follow them. He's talking about Daryl and the group. And then we get a flashback to Jocelyn trying to leave to find her friends, and Michonne asks what she needs. She just says, I need your help. I question Aaron's logic in this scene.
What do you mean?
So he's like, he comes up to Michonne and he says, doesn't look like they were followed. Daryl covered his tracks. And then also Aaron says, if those skin jobs are looking, they'll find us soon enough. And I don't know how those things are not completely incongruous. Like, Daryl did a great job. No one followed him. And yet they're bound to find us immediately. Why?
I think both those, because they're like, the communities are all in somewhat close proximity. So it's like, you if a trail, you can go right there. But if they just do any kind of like systematic search of the county, they're bound to find them sooner or later. So I think it's like one of, that you're supposed to understand. It's that it's like
even though they haven't run into them in the last 10 years. I don't know how long they've been in this apocalypse, but they've never encountered them in 10 years. And now suddenly,
yeah,
they're bound to find us.
Are these guys local? Because I assumed that they rolled in like with some herd that they've been following. But didn't they establish that she started in like a Baltimore or East Coast shelter? And I think they even she's even got the sketch of a Baltimorean accent that the Alpha is going for. I think they should have maybe made this like a New York or Philadelphia based something that's like far enough away that you wouldn't maybe bump into each other, but also close enough that you could follow here on foot, especially since we got a group of survivors that went from Georgia to Baltimore, you know, like they had a great migration of their own. So it is weird world building staging that they've done.
Yeah. I was a little disturbed by the shortened version of Michonne being Mish. Something seems off about that to me, but I guess like I was trying to think what would you call her? Would you call her
Shone?
Yeah. Like just call Shoney. Her own. I don't know.
Yeah. It's
Mish
it's,
works.
Mish is fine. I guess like Michelle, Mish.
All right. Then we are still in flashback. We get a bunch of the group taking Jocelyn to find her friends. They succeed and they realize, oh, they're all kids.
Yep, that's what they do.
Yeah, I don't know if you have anything to say. Like I said, this outline, this recap is going to be like real chunky because
that's fine.
The episode is real chunky. So Henry's worried about, we're back in the present day. Henry's worried about his stitches leaving a scar. Lydia thinks it's sexy. Michonne talks one-on-one with Lydia and tells her how much she wishes she would just walk off into the woods by herself, thereby eliminating all risk that she's putting on everyone else, which, god damn, Michelle or Michonne.
It's... it reminds me of kind of like what Russ Cole did, where he gained that one woman's trust that, and then like put in the mind that she should commit suicide because she's such a terrible person that can't ever be forgiven. It's kind of like she uses that kind of, she switches on mom mode just long enough to get Lydia to kind of relate to her and then twist the knife.
They really needed to bring Carol in for this because Michonne, man. I've never seen Michonne do anything that would make me think this is something she'd do. Whereas Carol would fall right into this, you know, bring a tray of cookies and convince Lydia somehow that this was her idea to walk off into the woods. Yeah.
See, I think Michonne is capable of it because, you know, what caused her to snap in the first case is losing her family. Mm-hmm. And now that she improbably has this, you know, post-apocalyptic family that she loves so much that she would be willing to do anything, including psychological warfare against a child to keep it. I thought it was in that like envelope of she'll do anything to keep her community safe at this point.
Sure. Yeah.
What Lydia fingering Henry's scar, like just really working her grimy fingernails in there and like, can I lace and unlace this? Can I find a moist tender part? And Henry's just like sitting there taking it. Like what? Who directed this scene? I want to know. Henry should have screamed. I get like maybe a 15-year-old girl's like, I'm just going to grab my boyfriend's scars because I don't know what the hell to do. I've been walking with the dead. I don't know how romance works. But Henry should be like, what the fuck are you doing? Get your fingers out of my wound.
Is this supposed to be like the mask? Because you know how they like stitch up the back of the mask?
That's why I was going, yeah, like I know how to lace these things up. I know. This is, I don't know. I thought it was very... It was a very bizarre way to play this weird fucking romance.
I mean, the episode is called Scars, so maybe they just needed to fixate on this for a little while. And I don't know what they're trying to do with that.
I think you're right. I think they're trying to draw some kind of thematic thing about, you know, not all scars, because like that was a preoccupation throughout the fucking episode. You know, Judith closes with a scar, not unlike Henry, and wondering if it's going to heal. And you know, not all scars are bad.
Daryl get the X's, like, yeah,
right. So I think, yeah, but also don't have her stick her dirty fucking zombie, previously zombie encased fingers in this guy's fresh wound.
And I don't know if look. At some point, he says, like, I got to get up, I got to walk around and make sure these stitches hold. Is that proper medical advice? Are you supposed to try to pop your stitches when you get them just to make sure they're going to hold? Do they have run a lap after the doctor puts them in?
No, but I guess the thought is, like, if you're about to be forced on a march to another community that's far away, it's not like you got a choice to just lay up for a day or two. They're going to kick you out, True. So might as well try it now where the medic is still there and you can redo it, then get 5 miles up the road and it just bust open.
I'm sure Daryl could carry him.
Or yeah, Daryl could fucking sew him up, yeah? He's just like...
Oh, yeah, with rabbit guts.
Get some squirrel gut or some rabbit gut and a fish hook and just, you know, I'll have y'all patched up, man.
Yep. Okay, moving on to Judith telling Daryl that she wants to help. They're kind of sitting by a river here. I don't know when Alexandria got a river, but apparently yeah, they like put in a water feature.
They did. They got a windmill and they got a river runs through this community now. They got like a little mill pond set up, sure.
She asks him to stay and she wants to help him. He thinks it's more important to move on and stay isolated so that Alexandria will be safe. And Judith starts lobbing the bombs, says, "What would Rick do?" Which,
WWRGD, man.
Score some points there.
What would
there.
Rick Grimes do?
I think it's cute. They're kind of sitting exactly like each other here, both knees tucked into their chest. I'm not sure what they're getting at with that, but there's definitely, I don't know, some bonding happening here.
I think it's what I assumed is that's good advice for dealing with children is like to get on their level and assume their posture, mirror their body language. And I just thought that like this is another example of Michonne probably reading a book or two about parenting and just being real good at it.
Oh, but this is Daryl and Judith.
Oh, it's Daryl. Oh, yeah, shit. Yeah, yeah. Well, then, okay.
He's terrible at parenting, I'm sure.
He's just a child. So he's just mirroring her body language unconsciously because that's how he's feeling on the inside.
I was wondering, if they were trying to compare like two children here. I think more of Daryl than that, certainly. But yeah, emotionally, he's got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, and I also like the idea that Judith is attracted to people who level with her, and Daryl's she asks Michonne, is the hilltop in danger? Of course not, sweetie. Everything's going to be fine. Daryl's like, I don't know, maybe. And he doesn't tell her everything, obviously, because that's not what his mom, her mom wants. But Daryl turns out he's a pretty good. There's a line later on in this episode that sketches him out to be this dad, and I kind of like thought, the hell are they talking about? But I start thinking, he's kind of a father figure to Henry. He's certainly a father figure to Judith here. I guess that's why not? Daryl, good dad. I'll go along with it. Sure.
All right, the flashback continues. Gabriel's playing the quiet game with the kids that they found. Michonne's sad that Rick didn't get to see it. And then she and Jocelyn talk about how children are the future, essentially. And she realizes Michonne can't live without knowing what happened to Rick and encourages her to go look for him.
And I think this is an amazingly written scene, and it really uses Ms. Wesley at her full powers, because Tara, her character in True Blood, is one of these characters where, like, you want her to be your girlfriend, or you want her to be your girlfriend's girlfriend, because she's just utterly reliable. She is challenging in the best kind of ways. She's, like, is an excellent listener, but she's also there in like an action capacity if you need her. And she just, I felt like she effortlessly slipped into this role. And, you know, like this is a really well-crafted speech, like her using the crazy coincidence of Michonne finding her with not ever giving up on Rick. And it really, when it turns out that she exploited Michonne at her, like one of her most vulnerable points, and exploited one of her oldest trust, it legitimately lit a fire in me. Like I was fucking pissed off at this woman. And I just think that's an excellent use of casting, like cast a person to be the kind of thing that you're used to seeing them play, but have that be the act. It's a really inventive way to use a character actor, and I thought they did just a great job, because this is such a wonderful scene. And like you could see, like, this is, man, if it had gone the other way, what if like Michonne just had her a right hand woman and all these kids surrounded, and like she never had this betrayal, like how different Alexandria and the kingdom and Hilltop would be. Just one of these, you know, like one of these events. I kept on thinking, like, what is the thing that's going to be fucking so bad that's caused all this crazy overreaction? And this episode completely answers it, and I think it's smart for that reason.
Still, after seeing this episode, no clue what happened with Maggie, which they've, you know, we know a little bit of behind the scenes stuff, and you know, Lauren Cohen is not coming back at the end of this season, and she's not coming back at the end of the next season. So
perhaps she comes back at the end of next season, or this
the finale hasn't aired yet. So far she's not back, and we still have a whole another season to watch, so they can't really push that too far forward.
And, I thought they established that she's with Georgie, though, right?
What's that?
Didn't they establish that she's with Georgie? That she went off.
Yeah, but
to
we
be
don't know what the. I don't think we know what the rift was. Like, why well, everyone is so pissed at each other?
I think. I don't even want to talk about that now because I guess I feel like that Michonne had this massive overreaction. And there's this idea that like it was a small faction within Alexander, like all these parents that were scared shitless that their children were abducted by these strangers that we thought we could trust, that we took into our intimate, that like we let their mother, and maybe this is kind of crazy, you let their mothers, you let this new girl watch all your kids because she's got a bunch of kids and sleep over for everybody. Like what if one of these kids is a Lizzie type, you know, is going to wake up and murder kids because they're traumatized or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But still, like they had this reactionary thing within their community. This like, you know, everyone is kind of like gearing up to sign this big compact. Everybody's on the same wavelength about all this shit. And then this massive reactionary cultural movement swept a community and turned it to kind of darkness, right? Like isolationist, mm-hmm. and you know, like fuck you, we got ours. And I can see that like being a huge like what Judith said later on. It's like, do we still love these people? Are they still our family? Why doesn't it feel that way?
Yeah.
If that state had been gone on for years, which they kind of imply, that's a lot of bad blood. Like how many people did Hilltop lose because Alexander wouldn't share medicine? Or how many, you know, like is there a couple old folks that starved in the kingdom because they wouldn't? I can see that shit kind of adding up. And, you know, I'm if they want to do some flashbacks to kind of like paint in those holes, that'd be cool, but I feel like I can squint and see.
I don't know. I think you're absolutely right. All those things could logically come of this shift in attitude, but something about it feels more personal. Something between the Maggie and Michonne dynamic here. Every time people talk about it, they speak of it in ways that feel very personal to me, and maybe they lose somebody important, although I'm struggling to think who they don't have in the current,
that's the thing,
you know, setup that would be personal enough to Maggie that she would be pissed off.
I wonder if she found out about like Maggie's involvement in the anti-Rick conspiracy. Well, no, I guess they kind of dealt with that this season when, you know, Maggie came to kill Negan and Michonne eventually led her, and then Maggie realized that Rick was right. So,
right.
Yeah, I guess if you're looking for something that's intensely personal.
I am. I don't know if that's where they're going. They could just be, you know, an ideological split here. And that just takes its toll, like you said.
Maybe they're going to deal with that when Maggie gets back.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so.
But no, I mean, yeah, like ideology, don't sell ideology short, man. Ideology can definitely split people in far more comfortable situations than they're living in.
I am well aware of that as an American. Okay, let's move on to Aaron and Daryl catching up as Daryl's group prepares to leave. Before they go, Daryl tells Michonne that she needs to let Judith know what happened to her father. And I was thinking, yeah, I'd like to know too. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of conspicuous shots of this manhole here, and I'm like, okay, they're clearly going to do something with that. Thought maybe someone was going to sneak in via the sewers. Turns out it's the opposite.
Yeah, like they go from, there's a dissolve where the sewer grate is unguarded, and then it's got like a big heavy piece of rebar welded over it, and it's like, yeah.
And yet, okay, they welded the rebar over the manhole, but the secret teen tunnel still wide open. Daryl went out that last episode, like two episodes ago.
Well,
I'm sure nobody's done a damn thing about it.
Yeah, well, if Jesus' college roommate had come back with a bunch of kids and used that tunnel to, you know, steal all the children and medical supplies and kill three people, they might have welded the teenage hole shut too. Who knows? But yeah, like Alexander, I guess, is like a police state. Governed over by Michonne, who is like this unelected dictator, supreme. Like she's wasn't that Cincinnatus, the Roman general? He declared himself dictator during a war condition, and of course he's famously gave all that power up. And Michonne is just an anti-Cincinnatus.
She's keeping the power.
She's a Clevelandatus. the equal and opposite of Cincinnatus in all regards.
Sure. Okay, back to the flashbacks. Michonne shows the new community members around. Actually, no, she's going to look for the new community member. So I don't know what's happening here, but she realizes the kids are gone.
Yeah, all the kids, they let have a big sleepover with all the other kids at Joss's place, the place that they assigned her. So all the parents are like, oh, yeah, it's a big sleepover. Isn't this fun? And they're going to collect their kids, and they're gone.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then that was confusing to me. And then it's like, then they realize their pantry's been cleared out, the armory's been cleared out, the infirmary's been hit. Like, because my other thought is like, how soft has Alexandria got that they don't even have fucking lookouts? But then they establish, no, the lookouts have just been murdered.
Yeah. Probably like, okay, by children, now that we've seen the rest of the episode, right? Probably by children,
which makes fucking sense, because I don't know how hard Alexandria have to be. The Night Watchman sees like a 12-year-old coming with him with the teddy bear and's like, who goes there? It's like, come on. It's like, hey, are you lost? And then they get shanked. That's a child soldiers, man. Terrifying. Terrifying.
So, yeah, you talked about it. They see the bloody footprints leading to the manhole, which, man, you know, we talked about how they'll set up a pin just to knock it down very quickly, like in the next episode. This is the next scene. They're just like, manhole cover, boom, bloody footprints, boom.
Yep.
Appreciating that. And then we go back to the modern day here. Judith isn't hungry at dinner, goes to her room. Michonne wakes up in the middle of the night to talk to her about Rick, but she's not in her room. So Michonne goes to see Negan. He hasn't seen her either. And she's suspicious about their conversations. She wants details. He gives them. He accuses her of being shifty with Judith, and that Judith doesn't agree with the ideas Michonne has about isolation. And Michonne realizes, oh, shit, she must have taken Rick's gun. And when she goes to look, she finds a note that says she went to help a friend.
I wonder how much Jeffrey Dean Morgan appreciates being given material. Like, he got so much shit that he just tried to sell with, like, his sly smile and his hydraulic, you know, lift implants. And now he can just, like, share a long, verbally complicated scene with another really good co-star and good lighting, dramatic lighting. Like, I thought this conversation really fucking crackled, and I kind of went back and forth on but once like Negan homed in on, well, yeah, you're right, she is, like, when she, like, Michonne with a head of steam starts doing all this my daughter shit, and Negan goes right after, it's like, yeah, she is your daughter. And just like you, she's got her own things on how things should be, and she's not taking shit lying down. I mean, that's that, and Michonne, to her credit, instantly gets it. And that's like, I think this is a path forward for her and Negan to work together, because Negan gave her an insight that allowed her to find and help her daughter. You know, because she started thinking, like, what would I do? You know, when I'm feeling upset, you know, kind of Mr. Rogers, what do I do if I'm feeling upset inside and I have feelings that I can't explain? We'll go outside and whistle and kill zombies, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great scene. It's a shame that Jeffrey Dean Morgan is confined. It took him being confined to a prison cell to get decent material to work with.
Yeah. But
what are you going to do?
And like all the stories he told, and like this, like Michonne kept looking for weapons to hurt Negan, and he, like, they just don't land because, like, no, I've been completely honest.
Yeah.
Like, I would have loved to hear the conversation about, like, what happened to Uncle Glenn, you know?
His eye popped out. Yeah, it wouldn't be a good one.
Yeah, but then he also tells stories on himself, how, you know, Carl got the better of him, how his dad beat him fair and square. Mm-hmm. And, and, like, the fact that then he goes after, like, you know, she's wanting to be, you know, as badass as Carl is, and she also wants things to be like Carl, like everyone did. You know, like, you've betrayed the memory, you've betrayed Carl's heirloom tomato, Michonne. You are the one who has crushed it beneath your heel. It's good stuff. It's very, very well written. It's really well shot, and they're acting the hell out of it. A+.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, more flashbacks. Daryl and Michonne are out looking for Jocelyn, and they pause to have a chat about how close she and Michonne were. She now feels deeply betrayed, obviously. Daryl knows about evil people and promises that Jocelyn will pay. They get moving again, and they come upon a kid that they chase into a schoolhouse where they get ambushed by a pack of kids. And then Daryl and Michonne are tied up by Jocelyn's kids and marked with X's.
This huge Chucky style knife that this PJ guy is running around with, I was kind of delighted, you know, like that's a serious fucking knife. That knife is almost as big as his whole torso.
Yeah.
Also forgotten to mention the last scene before the flashback is Michonne going to open Judith's gun case. It's got this adorable written in crayon little girl hand saying, essentially like Henry, you know, it didn't sit well with me, or I got to go help my friends or something. I just thought that was, we've seen that like three times this season alone, but seeing it in crayon at the hand of like a 9-year-old girl, I thought was, you know, an especially nice touch.
Yeah.
But this shit is, this stuff is pretty fucking grim, to the point where, like, I was wondering how that Daryl and Michonne would get out of it.
Right.
What did you
Are you
think?
Still wondering?
Yeah, like, does Daryl have, like, a coke nail that he was working the ropes with?
Sure.
I mean, I he believe that he's got
he,
a
he just whistled and an army of squirrels came in and chewed the rope for him.
just trained squirrels. Uh-huh. I mean, I honestly, I can almost believe it. I'd believe that he has a little bit of wire on him or a razor blade tucked in a wristband or something, that he's just like MacGyver, you know? He's like a backwoods demented MacGyver, and if you give him a paperclip and chewing gum, you're going to fucking regret it, and he's probably got that shit on him. But
and that's
kinda,
why it works when they just smash cut to him out and murdering the guard, right? Like,
yeah, like invent your own Daryl escape. Yeah. But I also think that Norman Reedus is just done doing stunt work. I think that's a big part of it, right?
If it doesn't involve riding a motorcycle, he's not going to do the stunt,
right? Like, I'll shoot your damn crossbow and I'll hold two knives in a menacing, but I'm not going to fucking do choreograph. And I'm not, get out of here, get out of here. I saw what you did to a stuntman two seasons ago. You murdered him. I want no part of it.
Ooh, too soon. How old is
fucking Scott Gimple? He's got a body count. Not only is the show bad, but he killed somebody making it. It's a tragedy.
Born in 69 makes him what, 51? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's got, yeah, like, I don't want to be working that hard in the Atlanta, Georgia heat and humidity for sure.
Yeah. He's no Liam Neeson.
I just think that he might be done. The days of Daryl killing a tank single-handedly and doing all that shit, it might be over. But okay. Then again, I'm waiting for the finale to have me eat my words.
I mean, it was pretty humiliating. Like, the king, the idea that Daryl would be brought down by an arrow is pretty hilarious to me. Being the king of the crossbow.
But is his kryptonite, like, what's Daryl going to do? Murder a bunch of kids? I don't think he's got it in him. I don't think if, like, you put him in Michonne's shoes at the end, I think Daryl dies. I don't think Daryl can mow down waves of damaged children. I mean, maybe he's...
Yeah, I mean, the difference is, like, Judith is Michonne's daughter, and she needs to do what she needs to do to protect her, right? Like...
Yeah, maybe
Daryl doesn't have that incentive quite the same way. You know, it's Rick's daughter, so I think there would be a little bit. He might think about it for a good long second, but
you're right. I might, but I'm just saying it like Michonne barely survived this without a psychic break. A psychotic break. I don't know that Daryl does.
Oh yeah, I think it would do damage to him.
And I tell you, you talk about the forcing these children to brand their adults. There's some kind of, complicated ritual of like mark your kill and kill your mark stuff, some shit like that.
Yeah, earlier in the episode, they show like a picture of like stringing up a deer and butchering it, like a diagram on how to do that. And it seemed like
that
was going to
eat them.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think they were going to eat them.
But like it was like so like do you brand that? That's your first step at dehumanization, and then you have to hunt the person down to kill them, because they said mark what you kill what you mark. I was wondering like why, because they clearly don't travel with adults. Obviously, that's something that Jocelyn is not going to tolerate. But I just want to say, you know, there again, Danai Gurira, like her primal scream right into Rutina Wesley's face was powerful. Yeah, that whole scene was about as rough as we've seen in anything in The Walking Dead. And the fact that children are perpetrating it and having things perpetrated just takes it to the next level. I'm actually impressed that the show did it and didn't fuck it up. Like, that's some really fuck... That's, you know, that's some... You're talking about wartime atrocity stuff here. And the show did it in a thoughtful way that really made you kind of sick. So kudos.
So there's a very quick flash forward to now, where Michonne encounters a bunch of walkers looking for Judith, and she screams her name. It seems like a bad idea.
Yeah, they didn't establish this, but that's Judith's bike, the rainbow kind of bike that's parked. Like, they didn't establish her. I don't think she had this bike, but that's because I had to rewind. Like, why the fuck is this happening? It's because she saw this kid's bike parked at the side of the road, and. Do you think Judith came out here, I guess, to catch up with Henry and what's, or do you think she just went out? I guess she went out there to help Henry and Daryl,
or specifically Daryl, I think.
Because I could also believe that she just go out there and kill zombies in frustration. You know, not quite being willing to run away, but that's what her note said. So
yeah, said she was going to help a friend. And then we go to the flashback again. Daryl gets loose and lets Michonne out. They go looking for Judith. And Jocelyn's kids fight Michonne. She's forced to bash one of them with one of their bones into dust with a pipe. They flee in terror, but not before slashing her pregnant belly. She manages to make it outside and murder Jocelyn, but she really doesn't want to kill any of these kids. Unfortunately, she has to kill like 12 of them before they relent. And she gets Judith back, along with a few new kids. And this is all intercut with her slicing down walkers, and every time in the present, right? So when she's looking for Judith in the present, she's slicing these walkers, and these walkers are stand-in for the kids that she's slicing in the flashback. It's all really, I thought, expertly crafted. It both connects the dots between these two situations, right, where Judith is missing in both, and she's desperately trying to find her. But it also serves as a way to not have to show her slaughtering children and still getting the point across.
Exactly. It's hard, like, even Michonne, as much as we like her, watching her murder a dozen children would be a lot. So this is like, I want to say a tasteful child murdering scene.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's as tasteful as it's like there's a Revenge of the Sith, you know, like that's another tasteful child murder scene. Master Anakin, okay. What are we to do? You know, then cut, then star wipe or whatever. But yeah,
this used to be how most murder scenes were done in cinema. And now
that's true.
We just show heads being lopped off and people being bisected and shit. So like, it, you know, this kind of harkens back to an older era of cinema in a way. But also like, I remember how surprised I was and how wrong it felt when Jackie Chan beat the shit out of a bunch of kids in Karate Kid, the remake.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is that times 12. If they had shown it, I don't know that I wanted that actually. Like, I'm glad that they steered clear of that.
Yeah.
And I'm a guy who likes to see a lot of perverse shit in his media. I go looking for those experiences sometimes. Like, this, I don't know that that's what I wanted in this moment. So good on them.
Because usually that type of entertainment, they don't ask you to connect too deeply with the characters.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, and here we have characters we love and care about. And I thought, like, going back to pre-time jump Judith, who is at the peak of her adorableness, like her coming and seeing her mom covered in blood and all these children that she was just playing with the night before lying dead at her feet and like being scared and unsure and then calling them. I saw it, like, you know, as a father myself, it's just incredibly, incredibly effective and told exactly the story they wanted to do. And it also, like, all these things, if I go back and listen to me ragging on Michonne about, you know, doing her crazy Morgan clearing and, you know, like, no, she's got a lot amount of poison inside her that she has to let out somehow in a healthy way.
Yeah.
So, like, I would have been a lot more sympathetic to Morgan had, you know, they shown him going through some shit like this. But even then, it's like, you know, Michonne's not going to do the Morgan thing. She had a reaction to a bad experience. She's had some distance put between that and her. And she's had people that she love and trust kind of gently lead her back to the light. And I don't expect her to go back into crazy Gestapo Michonne mode. I'll be very disappointed if she does. So it's a nice long season arc for her. Mm-hmm. What do you know?
Then Michonne and Judith in the present day talk about what she did to save her that one time she was kidnapped by the Lord of the Flies. Judith remembers it, which surprises Michonne. And she also realizes that she understood why she was doing the thing she was doing the entire time. Judith is sad because she feels like they don't love their friends anymore because they're not doing what it takes to help them.
Yeah, well, we never stopped loving them. And that's like, that's the difference in words and action, right? Words and deeds. You know, it's easy to say you love somebody, but it's very hard to sacrifice and pay the time and attention like you do care about them. So, again, I'd like this all done at Carl's graveside. It's tragic because she's trying to protect Judith from something that she didn't need protected. And that just harmed their relationship because she just sees her mom, you know, carrying all this guilt and shame and, you know, being not trusting her to handle things in an adult manner that she's already been. And it must be especially frustrating because not only does she have personal memories of it, but she's also been talking to Uncle Negan and Uncle Daryl and be getting kind of straight poop anyway. So it just alienated her from her mom. And, you know, that's another thing that Negan threw back at her. It's like, you know, if you were straight with her, maybe you would be having this conversation with her instead of me right now. Mm-hmm. So she's now having that conversation. It's again, a nice little through line.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's complicated, right? I mean, Michonne, you know, by saying, Judith is saying we got to go help the ones we love, demonstrate their love, but also, she's got an entire community to consider and, you know, some amount of protectionism here or whatever is warranted, right? You don't want to just let everybody in. And I like, you know, what Judah says, kind of to rebut the idea that they would just cut themselves off is they've beat Negan. They've beat the saviors. They can do it again if they need to, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think she's right about that. So it's complicated. I ultimately think Judith is correct. You know, they can't just abandon people and for the sake of like not getting involved. But
right.
Yeah, there will be prices to pay. And I think we're going to see one coming up pretty soon here with the Whisperers, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the tension, right? Like, yeah. It's a weak society that retreats upon into itself and becomes fearful. It's a strong society that realizes that they can handle, you know, challenges will come up, and they'll be able to handle it because they have a strong community and they're there for each other. Mm-hmm. And they do this all in a very show not tell kind of way. I think just really connected with me.
So another flashback here. It's quick. Daryl and Michonne return to Alexandria with the children, and they shut the gate for good behind them. At least for X amount of years, 6-7 years. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then we go to,
and they also dislike, you know, the gates ominously closing, like you're understanding this is Alexander closing itself off from the world. Like this is the last time Alexander will be like open and charitable towards people. Mm-hmm. And it feels like, like the sound cue, even of like that exaggerated, like prison clank, it just feels like Alexander's got put on lockdown. It's very nice.
Yeah. And then we go back to now, where Michonne takes Judith to Carl's grave, tells her about how the loss of Rick has rippled through the community, how they reacted by forsaking what Rick wanted in the first place, just to try and keep themselves safe. And then she vows to protect everyone they love, and they drive the wagon out to the road and find Daryl's group just kind of waiting out there. I don't know if they were on the road and ducked off of it when they heard a wagon coming and then came back when they realized it was Michonne, but like it seemed a little convenient. They pick him up, they head over to the kingdom, and I guess they're calling them skinwalkers. I've heard that term in this episode, but you know, the Whisperers get eyes on them, eyes on the gates of the kingdom.
I think it's funny that, and I don't know if they're doing this because the Whisperers are what they're called canonically in the comics.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of funny that their stubborn refusal to call them Whisperers when it seems like it's the most skin jobs and skinwalkers and live zombies or live walkers and all this shit. It mirrors this show's refusal to call zombies zombies. Uh-huh. Like, we're just never going to use the canonical, you know, it's weird.
It's one of those things I love as like a big zombie fan. Every single zombie movie has like the nickname they give to the zombies, sure. Right? Very few actually call them zombies, call them deadheads, dumb fucks, whatever. This show has consistently done that with new groups of survivors, which I like. And now extending that to whatever these things are, Whisperers, skin jobs, whatever.
I think it's awesome. Like you extend the courtesy to your own IP that you don't refer to it by its extra universe name.
No, it does things like that tell me that the group of people making this show do actually love zombie movies, mm-hmm. right? They love that genre. And as someone who has loved that genre for a long time, I think it's great. It's great.
Yeah, agreed. And I also like, is Michonne's wagon a little sporty?
Is it a chopped minivan? Is that what
I was thinking it might be a chopped minivan or a chopped like Geo Prism or something. It's very small, low slung. And crucially, their headline is below the horse's asses.
So they're just not only are they
getting just blasted with shit stench every couple miles from my horse experience, but also they can't see where they're going.
Right.
Their front view is just a horse ass, man.
Look, man, if we're going to have a community, we got to trust the horses. We got to trust them.
I guess so. I think that low slung vehicle would not be a great candidate for becoming a horse buggy. But
I want to see one of those lifted, like the big ass, you know, like 45-inch tire trucks. I want to see.
Cause monster truck?
Come on, it's Georgia. Okay, it's not Georgia, but it's Georgia. Like they're, mm-hmm. they've got to be around. They've got to be around. Just get a big lifted truck.
You can get. I mean, that's the thing. Outside of every American city, it's not like New York State is fucking, you know, mega city one, right? You get an hour outside New York City, you're in the land of lift trucks. Like they'd be everywhere. They'd be everywhere, of course.
It'd be hilarious, and as you pointed out, more effective.
Truck nuts dangling from the
mm-hmm. I don't know how you load one of those things though. Like
that's true. Yeah, it's
you need a ladder and you gotta Yeah. A pulley system? I don't know.
Yeah, I bet that's one of the... maybe we've given the blacksmith shit this whole time, but I bet there is a complicated relationship. Like, hey, if you make the wheels bigger, they roll easier, and they're less likely to sink in mud, but you reach a point where it's above shoulder height, and you can no longer like load it effectively. Uh-huh. I bet the Constantinoga wagon is like the evolutionarily ideal form of wagon. So maybe the blacksmith is like, yeah, you know, we could try 12-foot wheels or 1-foot wheel. What the fuck? I don't know. Or we could just go with the tried and true.
Yeah.
Don't know why Michonne's going around in a fucking bombed out Fiero, because that can't be the ideal transport for anything, but you know what do I know.
Yeah, that's it, man.
Did we get the worst scene, the whispers debating about whether they should tell
Alpha? I mean, the worst line is we must tell Alpha. Yeah, no shit.
Yeah. So they've got everything. They've skipped Alexandria. They've gone straight to the kingdom. Uh-huh. I wonder. So it seems clear to me that all the heroes are going to be at the kingdom, and then the Whisperers are going to attack it. But I don't know what happens after then, because my gut fear is that's just going to launch a whole new round of Morgulizing. That, like, you know, Michonne just got this idea that, hey, you know, maybe we go and protect, and then they go and a bunch of people die and the kingdom gets overrun anyway, and we did all this to save the kingdom, and like, why does it even matter? Although, I don't know, that's kind of justifiable. Maybe I would be down for another line of, like, maybe Michonne wants to stay the course, but like, people like Aaron are just like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, we just finally all got on the same page with you, and now you wanting to be this swashbuckler that's uniting the kingdoms on that stuff. I shouldn't be too quick to dismiss the Morgulizing, because there's actually interesting sociological arguments for it this time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, before the Morgulizing was all focused on Morgan, right? And like, every season, you know, I'm being generous, every season, every episode he'd switch back and forth and he'd have this conversation with himself, right? And he'd be essentially just looking in the mirror going, do I kill? Don't I kill? I don't know.
Yeah. White knuckling a stick. Am I going to?
Right. But this is interesting dynamics between community members, right?
And between communities.
She's kind of creating a monster, and now that she's created this monster potentially in Aaron, who, you know, is more Michonne now in the isolation department than Michonne is, she doesn't have the leverage to change his mind the way that Judith changed hers, right? I can't see, like, is it Jesus? Is there, that would only push him further down that road, right? Like, there's nothing, he needs to have the experience she had, to come back from that place, and I don't know what's going to get him there at this point.
Yeah.
So
yeah, for sure.
This could be a battle between, you know, the council being split again and Aaron being overridden and Aaron going, well, fuck this, I'm going to take matters into my own hands. Who knows?
Because that's another theme of the, like, you know, they got this loose hierarchy of government, but then if you're a named character, if you're a star of the show, you can just kind of go rogue and decide, fuck the council decision, I'm going to leave, and, you know, what the hell, I'm outside the walls, what are you going to do? The worst you can do is not let me back in.
Yeah.
That's that cowboy kind of stuff is something they're going to have to rein in, too. This goes back all the way to season 3, Carol unilaterally deciding to kill people and infected in a prison, you know? Like, is the council got teeth or not? I'm looking forward to all this proto-government kind of stuff. It's going to be cool.
Not to mention the fair's coming up. And I don't know what the fair is going to be. There's going to be a movie and there's going to be a big paper tiger. And I'm excited for whatever it is.
Tiger. Right. Yeah. No, this is going to be fucking awesome for sure.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what the Megabus does.
Uh huh.
It's going to transform into a big yellow lizard that eats cars.
The dunk tank, I'm sure, will be spectacular.
Bossasaurus. Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah.
All right. I think that's it for the episode.
Yeah. We are coming in hard on to the end of this season. We got 2 episodes. Next week's the penultimate. The week after that will be the finale. And at the finale is probably where we're going to consider feedback again. So if you've got some backlogged, we've been getting some in week by week. But if you'd like to shoot an email shot at us, you can do so at watchingdead@baldmove.com. We'll collect those and go over everyone's thoughts going into the season 9 finale in just a few weeks. I cannot wait. Cannot wait to see this fair debacle that is shaping up.
Yeah.
But that's it for Walking Dead. We finally figured out what the scars are. Thank God. I was really afraid I was going to get spoiled a time or two when I was looking up people's names on Walking Dead Wiki. I made it. I made it through without being spoiled. Hopefully everyone else did too. We'll see you next week for the penultimate episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.